And before we begin the work schedule for the day, I'd like to turn to Janet, has a couple of introductions for the committee. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I wanted to introduce to you, you may have already worked with her, Heidi Altmaier, who works for Legislative Council, and she's a drafter that will be doing most transportation bills. So if you haven't met her, she's here today and probably going to listen in because there may be an amendment discussed for the airport bill, the first bill up. And Tim Walker, and he's the fiscal analyst that will be doing most of the transportation fiscal impact statements down in the Legislative Fiscal Office, and he hardly ever gets out. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good. Thank you, Janet. Okay. We'll try to move through our schedule in an expeditious way today. I know a couple of bills we may have to bring back for some amendment, but I think we'll get the substance done today. So with that, let's open up public hearing on Senate Bill 139 and ask that Bob Hidley and Joe Smith come forward, representing the Oregon Department of Aviation and the Oregon Department of Aviation Board of Directors. And before you begin, I'll ask Janet to give us a brief summary of the bill that's before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 139 is at the request of the Department of Aviation and would require the operators of public use airports in Oregon to notify the department 180 days prior to the closure of an airport. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. And with your packet today, we gave you a list of the 97 public use airports, and it should include the ownership who owns them as well. And I also wanted, at your place, we included a letter from the Oregon Airport Management Association from Ann Crook, who used to be the director of the Aviation Department. And they are supporting the bill if there's an exception made for temporary closures, and they suggest adding the word permanent before the word closure in the bill. You can see it's a short bill, and these two gentlemen may be able to address the reason for that, too. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Okay. I'm Chairman Maxler, members of the committee. I'm Bob Hidley, Director of the Department of Aviation. And with me is
Joe Smith, member of the board.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for having us here today. Senate Bill 139 is very important to us. Nationwide, there are many airports closing, actually averaging about one a week nationwide. And our concern in Oregon is that if a public airport is going to close, we'd like to have notifications so that we can possibly change the outcome, or if not, at least do the best we can to have the least impact on the community, and also users of the airport would need time to leave and go somewhere else with their aircraft or their business. And so that's why we're very much in favor of this. I also wanted to mention that our department gives grants to airports in the state, both pavement maintenance program grants to maintain pavement, and also financial aid to municipalities or FAM grants that we use from revenue that we receive mainly from fuel taxes. And we're concerned that if we gave a grant, or it could be a Connect Oregon grant or some other form of grant, that if we gave a grant to an airport and then it closed, it wouldn't be a very good expenditure of the taxpayers' funds. What the FAA does, 57 of the airports in the state are federally funded out of the 97 public airports. And those airports that receive federal funding, when you receive a grant as the airport owner, you have to give the FAA an assurance that it will remain open for 20 years. So we intend to do the same thing for the grants that we give out in the state. So if an airport receives a grant, they will need to remain open or pay back those funds if they decide to close. So that's what we would do if an airport closed in the future. So, Joe, your comments?
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Joe Smith. I'm a member of the State Board, and I'm appearing today on behalf of Mike Burrell, who is the chair of the board, who was unable to be here to give his statement, so I'm going to be reading his statement on his behalf, and then I'll have a couple of comments of my own. So,
Mr. Smith, we do have the written testimony, so you don't need to read that. So I would appreciate your personal observations.
And what I would like to underline is the portion where Chair Burrell refers to the need for an or clause. He doesn't use that language, but there should never be, or almost never should there be, a bill that says you have to do something or that you cannot do something that doesn't have an or clause. Some people call it an or else clause, and this one is completely lacking any or else clause. And so we hope that the committee will examine ways of enforcing the three lines that are in the bill itself. And there are various possibilities. One, for example, would be to give the department the authority to enjoin closure if somebody attempted to close without complying with the 6-month notice, or even allow a tenant to do that. Another might be to require giving 6 months' notice to a tenant of closure, so that, for example, somebody has their airplane hangared, doesn't come one day, and they're told at the end of the month you have to move your airplane. There are various ways, and I know the department would be happy to explore those possibilities with you. And then I would agree with Ann Crook's suggestion that the word temporary, or permanent rather, or something to that effect would be appropriate, because obviously if you're going to close an airport because you're repaving the strip and it's going to take 2 weeks, that should not require 6 months' notice for that.
Okay, well, thank you. Okay, let me just understand something. Joe, both your comments and Mr. Hidley's comments were referring to the use of federal funds or state funds and, you know, the closure aspect of it, and why it's really, really important to have some kind of authority over that or some understanding of what's going on. But the bill before us has nothing to do with that. It says nothing about that. It just says you have to be notified of a closure. I mean, and Mr. Burrell's written comments and in your comments talking about that, there's no provision on this. So are you anticipating some type of language relating to what you told us? Because this bill does not have any impact on that.
No,
we just wanted you to know that we would be doing that separately from this bill. This bill is just to give us notification that an airport would close.
So you have another piece of legislation, you mean, that would do that?
We're going to be making this a rule in our department. It won't be legislation. It'll be a rule, administrative rule, that will be.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if I might comment, I don't think any additional authority is required for the state to say, if you take our money, there are some things that you have to agree to. But there are a lot of airports that do not receive state money. And they, for example, and I don't want to start a rumor because I don't think there's any possibility it's going to happen in the near future, but an airport, I would hope, near and dear to Senator Starr, Starks at Twin Oaks. It would be a real hardship on the community, on the aviation community, on businesses and so on, if Twin Oaks were to close. And if we're going to close, they at least ought to give 180 days notice that it's going to happen, because there's going to be a lot of adjustment. And Twin Oaks may not receive any money from us at all. So this bill would cover airports, period. And then one of the things that the department can do as a carrot and a stick is, when it is getting money, to put in that, and the department is going to do that. But that's just for informational purposes.
Okay. Another point on that, this also goes back to Mr. Burrell's written testimony, and on page 2, third paragraph from the bottom, and he makes a point about penalties, because the bill requires, it says you have to notify, but there's no penalty if you don't notify.
That's what I'm talking about, an or clause.
And he says, yeah, make the requirement, but I'm not a lawyer, although we have them here, but it would seem to me that you need to have the statutory authority to assess penalties for this, and it's not in the bill. So we would have to write that in there.
Exactly.
For that. Okay.
Exactly.
But you believe your rulemaking is sufficient for the other issue that you brought up?
Right.
I believe so, yes.
Okay. All right. We have a couple other people on this bill, but I would like to see if there's any questions for the department or the board before we move on. Okay, we may have some still. I'll let you sit back, and I'm going to ask Dave Martin and John Horn to come forward to identify yourselves and who you represent, and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chairman Metzger and members of the committee. My name is Dave Martin. I live on Airport Way in Independence, and I'm the president of the Oregon Pilots Association. OPA supports Senate Bill 139 as a step toward protecting Oregon's airports from fast-track closures often aimed at airports for quick development or a presumed increase in property tax collections. OPA sees all of Oregon's airports as vital not only to the pilots who use them regularly, but also as a safety asset for the local community and for transient pilots. A member of our board believes she owes her life to the availability of a small coastal airport during an emergency. OPA, which was founded in 1938, is an organization of volunteers with more than 800 members. Near the top of our goals is the protection and enhancement of Oregon's airports. Please support Bill 339. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Burton. Mr. Horn?
Good afternoon, Chairman Metzger and members of the committee. My name is John Horn. I live on Piper Street in Independence, and I'm the president of the Independence Air Park Homeowners Association. Independence Air Park is a residential community, aviation community. It's adjacent to the Independence Airport. There's approximately 350 residents there and approximately 150 aircraft in the air park itself. The Independence Air Park Homeowners Association supports passage of Senate Bill 139. In the United States, general aviation airports are being closed at an average rate of 2 per month. It might be 4, like Mr. Hidley said. I'm not certain, but I know it's at least 2. What is general aviation? Simply stated, it is all civilian flying, except for the scheduled air carriers, Alaska Airlines, Northwest, that kind of thing. Approximately 65% of all general aviation flying is for business or public services, for example, law enforcement. Over 75% of all flights in the United States are general aviation flights. Why is Senate Bill 139 and its requirement for 180-day notice so important? There's much misunderstanding by communities and government leaders about an airport's value. Airports benefit communities in so many ways, they are hard to cover. Airports may be targeted for closure for a variety of reasons. Could be desire for other development, concerns for safety, and noise. Senate Bill 139 will allow for a fair and reasonable opportunity for all the pros and cons to be considered before a final decision is made. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Horn. I think the first question I would ask, you two gentlemen may or may know the answer to that, but usually we get a piece of legislation like this because something has happened and the light bulb goes off and say, hey, you know, we don't have anything that makes them tell us this. Are you familiar with a particular recent situation that might be an example of what we're talking about today?
I don't know of an example in Oregon, but the best example in the country is Miggs Field in Chicago, which was on the lakefront, and the mayor of Chicago, Mayor Daley, spent years getting essentially permission to close the airport, but he did it in the middle of the night by bulldozing the runway and stranding more than 150 aircraft, and the FAA has imposed a large fine on the city for doing that, even though he legally had approval to close the airport. The way he did it without notification to pilots who were going to fly in or out of Miggs Field was scandalous. So this is the best known example of an airport closure that that really affected a major city, Chicago.
Mr. Chairman, I believe there was another one just recently. I think it came out favorably. Wasn't that Long Beach down in California? But at any rate, if you needed some names of airports that are undergoing this experience right now or have recently, we can get that for you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that would be helpful.
Question?
Yes. Janet would have a question.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and it may be more appropriate for the department, but the bill speaks to operators, not owners of the airport, and it seems like an operator's franchise or lease or something could expire and the operator fully expects it to be re-upped or something, and it's not by the owner, and so it seems like it might be an owner responsibility there too. I just wondered about the use of operator in the bill instead of owner, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it might be a term more appropriate for Mr. Hidley to address.
Okay. Mr. Hidley?
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
We use the word sponsor for the person who owns and operates the airport. That's the FAA, the government term we all use, sponsor. So maybe you should put the word airport sponsor in the bill, not operator or owner.
Person responsible for the operation.
Okay, thank you. Questions by the committee for any of the people who have testified before us? Senator George.
Thank you, Chair Metzger. I got a little bit of, when I looked at the list of the folks who are operating these, there's, what is there, just like 15 that are privately being operated, 15 airports that are privately operated. Is this bill targeted more towards the municipalities and the other special districts, or is it targeted more towards the individual private airport owner?
It's any public use airport.
So, just so I understand, has there been any discussion with those folks who are the private airport operators specifically about this bill? Have they been included in the creation of this bill? Are they aware that this bill is going forward?
We've talked about it at our state aviation board meetings. We haven't sent a notification out to every airport in the state. We haven't done that.
Thank you.
But all this would require, a lot of public use airports are privately owned, and all this requires for them to give us a 100-day notice that it's going to close. It wouldn't prohibit them from doing it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Bonas.
So if this bill does pass, would there be then, and then would you be notifying all of the airports?
Yes, we could do that.
Just a quick question. Yes, Senator. Follow up on Senator George's question. Don't you think it would be prudent to, especially the private-owned airport, air parks, to notify them of this potential bill?
I didn't understand your question.
Don't you think it would be prudent for the department to notify the owners and operators of the private airports that the department was bringing this bill to the legislature?
We can do that. I'll be happy to do that. We have not done it other than making public announcements at our meeting that we're discussing this information.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you. We do have a letter in our packet, and I don't know if this, Senator Starr, covers how many of those individuals from the Oregon Airport Management Association. In talking about an amendment, I mean, obviously there's been some, but I think your point is well taken. We don't know the totality of the notification, and we're going to have a few things we have to put in the bill, so it may be a good idea to do that, so when we do bring the bill back with whatever amendments we may have, that we don't produce additional questions at the time. I want to point out, just in the audience, we have Bob Altimus, Jennifer Keller, and Larry Weber from the Oregon Department of Aviation, who came today in support of the bill, so I just want to recognize them here today. I think what we need two things for sure. One, we need to look at the definition of the responsible party, and we've talked about owner, operator, and now sponsor. So I think we want to make sure we have the responsible party being the one that has to do the notification. So that would be part of an amendment we would need for the legislation. The second part of that, as to Mr. Burrell's comment that Mr. Smith brought before us, the comment about, okay, what penalty? I mean, what's the enforcement mechanism to make sure that someone does notify you? We need to have something put in for that. And I think if you will work with the department, with Janet on that, we'll prepare that. We'll bring the bill back. I think we'll wait a few weeks, members, to bring the bill back, in order to also give you an opportunity just to send out a notice, whatever your normal channels are, to the, as Senator Starr mentioned, the private airports, so that they know that the bill is in the process, what we're doing. That'll save us, and I think you as well, any additional work by the time we bring the bill back, and we'll have all the issues on the table and can deal with them then. Any other questions? Senator Montes Anderson.
And I think I read somewhere in here, or it was in testimony, that I think there needs to be clearer definition on closure, because you do close airports due to weather or due to whatever. So
yeah,
that would be the third thing.
Yes, that's right. Absolutely right. The temporary closure issue that you brought up versus the permanent closure. So those are three elements that we have. Any other questions or thoughts for the committee? Okay, with that, let's close the public hearing of Senate Bill 139 and thank Mr. Smith and Mr. Hidley and Martin and Horn for coming forward. We are now going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 224, going into choo-choos now. So we're going to go from airplanes to choo-choos. And Janet, if you want to give us a synopsis of Senate Bill 224.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Senate Bill 224 is a shorter, probably the shortest bill you've ever seen. Repeals the statutory list of qualifications for state-employed railroad inspectors, and we did include in your material a copy of the ORS that's being repealed, and it is also short, but it does list a specific experience for education requirements. The department, this is requested by the Department of Transportation, and they're here to explain the bill. I did want to let you know that I got a phone call this morning from Delmer Hansen, representing the United Transportation Union. These are railroad conductors, brakemen, and engineers, and they are solidly in support of Senate Bill 224.
Thank you, Janet. So, Kelly, that be you?
Mr. Chair, while she's coming up.
Yes.
It's about time agencies bring us bills that repeal statutes.
I have a funny feeling Kelly may have her opportunity to replace it at some point in the process.
More than likely.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Kelly Tater with ODOT's Rail Division, and we did bring forth Senate Bill 224, and we have worked with the railroads themselves with this, the short lines, the class ones, and the United Transportation Union. And the reason we've asked to repeal this is because railroad inspectors are the people who are out there inspecting track or rail equipment, the operating practices, hazardous material shipping. Each one is a discipline in itself. It specializes in a particular piece of the rail industry. And the reason that they only specialize in one discipline is because the subject matter is very complicated. The regulations through the Federal Railroad Administration are quite complex. And each one just becomes the master of that particular discipline. And because of its complexity, it also requires very specialized related rail experience. In other words, if you're going to be a track inspector, you know a lot about track. And you have a lot of experience about track. This particular statute's been on the books many, 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 many years. I tried to go back to find out how long it's been on there, a long, long time. And I talked to a lot of people who've been around a long time. They couldn't remember how long it's been on there. But what's happened is it's very limited on the types of experience that I could require someone to have. So when I'm recruiting for a particular, say, hazardous material inspector, the particular statute today doesn't even recognize that experience. And that's what I need for a hazardous material inspector, is experience related to that. So looking at the Federal Railroad Administration's requirements and Department of Administrative Services, their classification and their experience requirements far exceed this and specifically line up, depending on which discipline you're hiring for, the type of experience that would meet that job need. So we brought you something that we said we think this statute was probably very useful in its time. It's outlived it. Rather than try to amend it, keep matching it up as things grow tougher, not less, we just as soon have it repealed so that we can effectively recruit in a timely manner based on the current qualifications.
Thank you. Excellent synopsis. Questions for Ms. Taylor? Okay. Thank you.
Would there be, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Would there be any opposition to
this? Well, I was going to ask for that next.
Mr. Chair and Senator Month Anderson, to my knowledge, no. Because what we're doing today and have been for some time exceeds this.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes.
So we assume that the class ones particularly are fine with this. Have any? I'm seeing nods in the back of the room.
Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, my understanding is they think good bills should pass.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. I will ask, Ms. Taylor is the only one that did sign up. Is there anyone else who would like to comment on this bill? Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 224. Open a work session on Senate Bill 224.
Sure.
Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 224 to the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 224 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And how about Senator Starr asking to carry that bill whenever we have floor session? Maybe a couple months, but.
Okay. Pipeline.
All right. Let's open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 223. Janet.
Good
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 223 is at the request of the Oregon Department of Transportation and the Office of Regulatory Streamlining, which is in the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and would allow a truck that has a fully functional alternative power unit for idle reduction to weigh up to 400 pounds more than the maximum allowable weight limit for that truck configuration, and would also allow trucks with such units to exceed the individual axle weight limits. This bill does contain an emergency clause and specifies that it would take effect on passage. Mr. Chair, I wanted to apologize to the Office of Regulatory Streamlining, because one of the bills we did yesterday was also one of their bills, and I forgot to ask Pat Allen from the Regulatory Streamlining Office to come up, and I don't see him here today. If he comes in, he may want to come up. This is another one of their package of bills, and the one we did yesterday from the Board of Accountancy was also, and I didn't recognize that.
Okay. Well, we have now been recognized, Mr. Allen. Greg Del Ponte, please come forward. Senate Bill 223.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Greg Delpani. I'm the administrator for ODOT's Motor Carrier Division. Senate Bill 223 before you this afternoon both conforms Oregon statutes to a new federal law, and it also promotes a good public policy outcome, reducing engine idling. The Federal Energy Act of 2005 became effective in February 2006, and that federal legislation mandates that states make an allowance for a 400-pound weight allowance for vehicles that are equipped with devices that are commonly known as APUs, and that stands for an alternative power unit. Trucks frequently, historically, when they are parked overnight or parked for any period of time, the truck is the driver's office. It's his hotel room. They will allow the truck engine to continue to idle, and it provides electricity to run the heating, air conditioning, any other kinds of electrical accessories in the truck. And, of course, that is consuming a large amount of diesel fuel, and it's creating emissions. The idea behind this bill is that an alternative power unit has a much smaller power plant. In some instances, it's similar or analogous to the diesel generator that you might find in an RV. And it consumes much less fuel, and it provides the same sort of electrical current. In other manifestations, it's entirely electrical. But in any event, what this bill does, it makes changes to bring Oregon law into compliance with the federal legislation by adding an exemption to the maximum axle and gross weights in statute to allow for the additional 400-pound weight allowance for units that have a fully functional APU device. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Delpani, and we certainly are wanting to encourage that. Questions for Mr. Delpani? Janet, go ahead.
I just have one question. As the bill is written, what if the power unit just weighs 200 pounds, are they still given the 400-pound allowance?
Mr. Chairman, Administrator Atkins, our intention is to publish administrative rules which will provide some additional specificity about how this 400-pound weight allowance will be provided. In other words, what axles, what groups of axles will be allowed the excess weight, and we'll address the issue that you mentioned in that rulemaking as well.
Okay. Yeah, I think the language says by not more than 400 pounds, and gives you some flexibility up to that point, especially as these units may change size, whatever. Other question? Yes, Senator.
So we assume that most of these units, there's a variety of manufacturers, but most of these units weigh less than 400 pounds. Is that the assumption? Or do we have any idea?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, I would anticipate that the authors of the Federal Energy Act of 2005
had an idea
of what number to use, and I suspect that's the case.
So, leap of faith, we'll go with for now. Any other questions? Thank you very much. No one else has signed up to testify on the bill. There are some people who might have an interest. I see you in the audience, so you don't need to come forward, but this would be an opportunity if anybody wanted to make a comment. Okay. If you'd like to. Oh, okay. All right. Thank you very much, sir. We know that if there's a question, that we would get a comment. So we always want to provide the opportunity in case. So let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 223 and open a work session on Senate Bill 223.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I need to provide a notice of a conflict of interest. I have an interest in a company that manufactures APUs.
So noted.
Having said that, I'd move Senate Bill 223 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 223 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. So I think we will ask Senator Deckert, would you be kind enough to carry this bill to the floor, of course? Okay. Moving right along. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 221 and again turn it over to Janet Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 221, at the request of the Department of Transportation, specifies that exemptions from certain state trucking laws do not provide exemptions from federal motor carrier safety regulations for operations that are in interstate commerce. And Mr. Chair, Greg Galpani is also here to explain this bill and the changes, the main changes on the very first section of the bill, lines 8 and 9, and the rest are clarifying. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Great.
Mr. Chairman, again for the record, I'm Greg Galpani, ODOT's Motor Carrier Transportation Division. Before you this afternoon is Senate Bill 221. Attached to my testimony, you will also find a letter from the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administrator here in Salem, Oregon. And when I read that letter, it perhaps is the more eloquent testimony, but I'll summarize what this bill is attempting to do. I'll remind the committee that a federal audit conducted in calendar year 2000 resulted in legislation being crafted in the 2003 legislative session, House Bill 2217, which served to remove the exemption from safety regulation that farm trucks enjoyed while they are operating in interstate commerce. The premise being that it is a requirement of federal law that Oregon safety inspectors have the same authority as their federal counterparts in terms of enforcing safety regulations whenever a vehicle is involved in interstate commerce. When the audit was conducted, they took particular note of these exemptions as they applied to farm trucks. There was significant discussion in the Legislative Assembly. House Bill 2217 was passed with the blessings at the time of the farm industry and the farm lobby. I'd like to point out to the committee that in the years since 2217 was passed, it has not been problematic at all for the farm industry how ODOT has gone about enforcing safety regulations. And in that regard, I'd just like to make the committee aware that in December of 2006, the Oregon Wheat League even bestowed an award on ODOT, attesting to their appreciation for the level-handed manner in which we've administered our safety regulations. The attached letter from the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration goes a step beyond what House Bill 2217 accomplished, and it observes that there are still on the books in ORS some state laws that are so broadly worded and interpreted that they could be interpreted to exempt vehicles from safety regulations while they are operating in interstate commerce. And the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration asks that we go one step further and make a clarification that makes it clear that any exemptions that Oregon revised statutes provide to the safety regulations, to the federal safety regulations, do not apply when vehicles are operating in interstate commerce. That's the intent of the bill. Senate Bill 21 establishes that state exemptions do not apply to vehicles operating in interstate commerce. We have shared this legislative concept broadly with our public advisory committee. I'm not aware of any opposition. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Delponte. Questions for Mr. Delponte? Yes, Senator Starr.
How broadly is interstate commerce defined? If you have a container of hazelnuts and you're moving it from the farm to the port, is that interstate commerce? You're not crossing state lines? It's all within the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, the definition of interstate commerce is oftentimes surprising to folks. Interstate commerce takes into consideration the fixed and persisting intent of the shipper. It's not so much a question of where the movement begins and ends. So that in your question, hazelnuts harvested in the field, delivered to the Port of Portland, if from the Port of Portland they're going to be put in a container without altering their material state, they're not going to be canned or changed in some way, just the raw product, put on a container and then sent overseas, that is in fact interstate commerce because the fixed and persisting intent of the original shipper was that it be an interstate or even a foreign commerce move. And so the example we used when we discussed House Bill 2217, farmers said, oh, I'm going to harvest grain, wheat grown in my field. I'm going to take it to an elevator in Biggs on the Columbia River. That's all I'm going to do, a 25-mile movement. That's intrastate, right? No, because from the grain elevator, it goes on a barge. From the barge, it goes to the Port of Portland. From the Port of Portland, it goes on a container, and it gets exported. That becomes interstate. So it is rather sweeping.
But the I think getting to another part of Senator Starr's question, though, in terms of concerns, the department has been administering the law as we had asked and as you had mentioned with the Wheat League and others, and not using it unnecessarily for impediments for our farming friends.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. I would be bold enough to venture that the folks we regulate are not displeased with our efforts, and yet we will share this session with the Legislative Assembly performance measure outcomes to show that we're achieving the public policy goals.
Thank you, Mr. DePlanion. I do appreciate the efforts you have made there.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Montesanto.
I just need clarification. Are regulations for interstate vehicles different than for regulations for intrastate vehicles?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Montes Anderson, yes, ma'am, they can be. There are variations, just as an example. There are hours of service provisions that apply to interstate vehicles that are different than hours of service regulations that apply to intrastate vehicles. However, wherever those exceptions exist, they exist and conform with federal tolerance guidelines that govern how intrastate regulation can differ from interstate. What we're doing with the bill in front of you here today, Senate Bill 221, is we're removing some variations, or actually I should say potential for variations, that are not allowed under the tolerance guidelines. The practical effect of passage of Senate Bill 221 is virtually nil. It will not affect the manner in which we are currently conducting safety regulation. It will remove a federal concern that our statutes are too broadly written.
Just follow up. So then, there aren't fees that an interstate vehicle has to pay versus one that's just used intrastate. I mean, are there, I guess that's what I'm trying to get at. Would it change a classification of a certain vehicle?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Montes Anderson, no. The registration, tax, fee structures are all consistent. This largely has to do with variations in safety rules.
Thank you.
I think it's to summarize it, to get the feds off our back and not threaten us with anything by clearing up our rules, right?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you very much. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Again, Mr. DePlanion, who does such an excellent job, is probably why no one else ever signs up. But if there is anybody in the audience who would like to comment on the bill, this is an opportunity to do so. See that some of the interested parties are there. Don't? Okay. Thank you very much. Let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 221, and open a work session on Senate Bill 221.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 221 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 221 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Montes Anderson, as we're passing around the gifts of the committee.
I'd love to.
Thank you very much. Our last bill of the day, which is set for public hearing only, we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 222, and again, turn it to Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 222 is also in response to federal legislation, but this is in response to the federal safety LEU legislation, and that is was passed a number of years ago, but the changes took effect, I believe, this January that are being addressed here. The first thing the bill does, you'd see in Section 4, it authorizes the Department of Transportation to enter into agreements with other jurisdictions for registration and insurance verification for trucks that are operating interstate. The federal legislation referred to preempts state registration programs and state insurance requirements for interstate motor carriers. So we can no longer require them to verify their insurance with the state. But that doesn't mean they'll be operating without insurance. It's just where they need to verify it. And then Sections 9 and 10 of the bill delete the requirement that trucks operating in Oregon but based elsewhere, again, file proof of liability insurance here. And thirdly, the bill deletes a requirement that trucks carry weight receipts or passes on their particular identification passes on their vehicle. The bill does need some amendments, Mr. Chair, and so the agency will explain those. And again, this is in to bring Oregon into compliance with this federal law.
Thank you, Janet. Mr. Delpani, shall we go for the hat trick?
Okay.
That's hockey.
One more time for the record, I'm Greg Delpani, ODOT's Motor Carrier Division Administrator. Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 222 is brought to you, as Janet observed, as a result of the passage in August of 2005 of the Safe, Accountable, Flexible, Efficient Transportation Equity Act, a legacy for users, otherwise known as Safety LEU. This particular public law has preempted existing Oregon revised statutes in a variety of ways, and it has also created a new multi-jurisdictional base state agreement. The preemptions of some of the existing Oregon revised statutory requirements took effect upon passage of the bill in August of 2005. However, we require legislative revisions to the statutes in order to honor those changes, so that's part of the bill before you. The other part of the bill, enabling Oregon through its ODOT to join the Uniform Carrier Registration Agreement, that takes effect in January of this year. So we have those two timelines we're dealing with. What this bill will do is it allows us to deal with the fact that effective January, there are some state regulations that are preempted. First of all, Oregon today requires interstate motor carriers to register with the state their USDOT-issued interstate operating authority. We're no longer allowed to require that they do that. Today, there's a requirement that interstate motor carriers must file with the state of Oregon a certificate of liability insurance and, in some instances, cargo insurance. The state is preempted from requiring those separate insurance filings with the state. Insurance filings for many of these carriers are required to be made with USDOT, and the second filing with Oregon is viewed as being redundant. There is a requirement that motor carriers operating in Oregon must display a weight mile tax credential called an Oregon weight receipt and tax identifier. Safety LEU prescribes that no state may require any motor carrier to display any credential other than those credentials that are required and called for in two other national base state agreements, the International Registration Plan, so a registration credential, and the International Fuel Tax Agreement, or fuel tax credential. Oregon's weight receipt and tax identifier falls outside of that, so it's disallowed. So Senate Bill 222, as it will be amended, we're working with legislative council, and I think we have reached agreement on what the amendments should say. They'll be prepared and brought to you so that we can see an A and gross version of the bill. We'll eliminate, we'll actually conform Oregon revised statutes to these preemptions. And then additionally, it will authorize the department to enter into this multi-jurisdictional base date agreement known as UCRA, or the Uniform Carrier Registration Agreement. For the purposes of registering interstate motor carriers, brokers, freight forwarders, and leasing companies, and then collecting an appropriate federally determined fee from them. And in so doing, the state will be providing the means for interstate motor carriers based in Oregon to meet these new federal requirements. If we were not to join the UCRA, the requirement to participate would still be incumbent upon interstate motor carriers based in Oregon, yet they'd have to look beyond our state borders for another state to facilitate their entry into the system and their observance of the new federal requirements. That, in essence, is what this bill is all about, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Delpani. Questions? Senator Mona Sanderson.
Really no question, but I do want to thank the department for coming to speak with me on these bills. It clarifies things.
Thank you. Any other questions by the members? Janet.
I just had a question of whether this UCRA supplants the International Registration Program, or they're different.
Mr. Chairman, Janet, they're different. This is a third base date agreement. The IRP remains in place. IFTA remains in place. This is yet a third base date agreement. Frankly, it's a fee generation mechanism that's within the federal legislation, and it provides the means by which, in essence, the federal government wants to have a roster of everyone who has interstate operating authority, everyone that has a U.S. DOT number, and everyone that falls into the categories of freight forwarder, broker, and leasing company. Then they have, for the first time, a single unified database of everyone who should be paying a fee, and this is a means to collect that fee. And also everyone that would be subject to these federal motor carrier safety regulations that apply to folks involved in interstate commerce, of which I spoke on the earlier bill.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Delpanti. Again, we have members from the trucking industry and the agriculture industry in the audience. Does anybody have any desire to testify on this bill? We're not moving it today, but if you have any comments you'd like to add. Okay. And let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 222. We'll await amendments on that to proceed further. Now, let's see. We have some committee bills at all today. Okay. So, yes, Senator Decker.
You may have done this at the outset of the meeting, but as long as ODOT is here, if you did it, in the recent round of inclement weather that we had, and ODOT, and I don't know how you organize with local and county cleanups, but it was nothing short of impressive, the effort that was put forth to in a very organized fashion to get the roads back up and running, and I just thought it was very, very impressive how that all came about relatively quickly. And a friend of mine who owns a furniture company said his trucks were back on the street within like 7 hours because of the efforts, and so thank you for what was, I think, a very impressive effort.
We'll pass that along. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Deckard. Any other comments? Then, it's Thursday already. So enjoy the afternoon. We'll be adjourned until Monday.